Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjublilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavallari, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. It is really my great pleasure to have with me as a guest today on University Matters and Campus FM, Professor Daniel Massa. He is also accompanied by Dr. Paul Schwireb, who, because we shall be discussing Professor Massa's new collection of poetry, will be doing some of the readings. Just a very quick word to leave space for the poetry about Professor Massa. He holds a BA honours and MA degrees from the University of Malta and a PhD from Edinburgh University, Scotland. His tenure at the University of Malta has included appointments as Head of Department of English, the Dean of Faculty of Arts, and in 1982 he was Maître de Conférence at the National University of Ivory Coast. From 1984 to 85, he was Scholar in Residence at Michigan State University. Returning to Malta, he was appointed Director of the Communication Programme, where I was fortunate to be his student for several credits, and the Centre for Distance Learning, as well as Coordinator of the American Studies Programme. He has many publications to his name, books of poetry, as well as those in his academic fields, many articles, papers and chapters. Perhaps his most well-known book, a real doorstopper, 900 pages, is the biography PSI, Kingmaker, Life, Thought and Adventures of Peter Serracino and Dot, which he published in 2013. Today we shall be discussing, as I said, Professor Massa's latest book of poetry, Barefoot in the Salt Pans, described as being characterized by seascape imagery, gripping in its vividness and its physicality. Welcome, Professor Massa.
Thank you.
And welcome also, Dr. Schwireb.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off by asking Professor Massa to read the poem, which reflects the name of the book, of course, Barefoot in the Salt Pans.
The blistering sun directly overhead, barefoot in the salt pans, her toes encrusting salt. The girl, ankle deep, wading down on her left knee, deftly she prizes a live sea urchin, cracks it unevenly in half, halts before a cragged, uneven monstrance, its spikes burnished bronze. On both her knees now, with her curled tongue, scoops the deep orange, fingered, fleshy roe, sea water racing silky through her throat, a spiky star raiding her mind, recalling midnight boat rides to the fragrant islands of the blind. And soon another find, a cragged enamel dolphin, palest of pale blue. Slightly later, still invading, a rusting fake Swiss army knife, its open blade an omen she must seek, its mauve cross blurred, its message almost faded. And as she turns her face to speak, male greedy eyes hover, watching in pain her every trespass. Over love and lust and beauty lost and wounded found, erupting bleeding spikes and petals to the surface, irreverently red, shading the sun. And it's not just her father's shadow urging her to go, just stop and go, rather a stranger, not a stranger, ready quite to circumvent his fevered white-hot memory, or vent his vicious rising anger now, cursing visions of vainglory, dinning his temple, marring his story. Scanning presences in her sanctuary, the girl springs to her feet in fright, shielding her monstrance, her fragile weight balancing her spare heel. Steals a fugitive glance, springs again to her full height, feeling the pain like a novice ballet dancer, laughing turns half a pirouette on the wider ridge of the mother-feeder salt pan. While her father, sensing danger, glowers as the daughter in the days of her flowers, in convivial laughter, like a heeled dolphin, pursues her ride, follows after total ritual slaughter, dancing like Botticelli's Virgin Bride in spring, on the crystal ring of the shallowest salt pens, her blue eyes shattered wide, wounded but unafraid of stranger danger, her blue-green eyes on fire, shattered in carnation petals and myrtle, shielding grief's divine desire, teasing, hounding, calling, the hunter turned hunted, tempting either to blades of error vile and vile misprision, or towards redemption.
And that was really the first part of the story, in the sense that there is another part that comes about. The first part was the promise of redemption, but then in the second part, which unfortunately we don't have time to read today, there is the achievement of redemption. I would like to ask a few questions that came up as I was reading some of the poetry. One question I wanted to ask you was about language. Listeners probably know you best as a writer of poetry in Maltese, and this is a collection in English. What are the differences for you? Or is there a difference between writing your poems in Maltese or in English?
Well, let's put it this way. I started writing poetry in English when I was in St. Michael's Training College, in English. Then, a few years later, I started writing Maltese. My first poem, I think, was Il Mewt Tassayit. And very soon after, actually, Delimara, which came out, I don't know exactly from where. And Delimara was well received. So that urged me to write more poetry in Maltese. And then I continued writing in Maltese. During the last 10 years or so, I've written many more poems in English than in Maltese. And some of the Maltese poetry I have also translated into English. That's because very often I used to attend conferences, Commonwealth conferences and so on, and I was invited to read poetry, so I translated some of those. Sometimes I even read Delimara in Maltese, just to give them a feel.
I'm sure they enjoyed that very much. Mm-hmm. Talking about the content, looking at you as an academic who has really read hundreds and thousands of poems and examined in a way that, you know, the normal sort of just somebody who's interested in literature would do. Do you find that it has enriched you? Do you find that it has ensnared you? Or a bit of both?
I think it has done both, actually. But I think it has ensnared me a little bit, but I try to break out. So break the net, move across, try to do something different.
Another question that I wanted to ask was about the style. Anybody who hasn't read this book won't realize that there are no capital letters, practically no punctuation, and in some of the poems there is a visual poetry a la E. Cummings, where you're looking at a poem not only from the words point of view, but also from the aesthetic point of view. I was wondering why you did this. I know that Jim Crace, in his foreword, refers to the percussion of your poetic texts. What do you do that for?
As Christ said, I hardly use a comma. So my idea was that it takes me so long to write a poem, you know? I mean, first it's in my head, and it's there for weeks. And then when I write it, I'm not pleased with it. So I write it again and again and again. And I normally write it about 17 times, because that's my favorite number. So after 17, I say, you know, this
it's
is
ready.
It. And there's so much to put in that the words here and there without commas and without punctuation can go to the left, to the right, up or down. And that creates, I hope, not confusion, but a wealth of ambiguity. And so that even when I read or when the reader reads it the first time, the second time, he might be finding something new. In the beginning, when I started writing poetry in Maltese, which is a long time ago, ages ago, I was furious that when I was reading poetry in Maltese, it was so simple. You could understand it in, you know, at first reading almost, which is okay. But I thought some of it was actually too simple. So I wanted to write something else. At that time, I was, really following T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, and other poets who are not immediately understood. So I tried to do something like that. I don't know whether I had succeeded, but it has been with me all the time. Don't just say one thing. Try to say one word, one utterance, and also try to give it a fullness, a depth, a richness of understanding.
Well, as a reader, I certainly found that challenging, but very, very interesting.
I hope not too confusing.
No, but not confusing at all. And it was lovely that it gave the reader this opportunity
to go back
and have a look at it again. Because time passes, we'll have to rush on. We can talk about perhaps some of the main themes of your poetry, in this particular collection anyway. And as we talk about them, I'll ask Dr. Shure very kindly to read some of the poems. The theme of renewal, I think that's really something that strikes one immediately in whatever poem you're reading, particularly the Design for a New Arras, that idea of the rich tapestry of life, which in your poem you actually change, really. And I think that if we listen to Dr. Shure reading it, perhaps we'll get some idea of what...
Related to the politics as well, eh?
Yes, you can. Yes, I'll be asking you about that afterwards. Dr. Shure.
I touched a chime of prime. I touched my blistered, chalk-marked heels and turned, descending. Touched a woman in labor, the child beating at the doors. At chime of prime, annumbre publique, in the anteroom to the tapestry chamber, bedazzled, I stood in wait with the weavers, a stalactite drip, the midwife weaving a moon in thread of blue and old gold. The tiger tore the back of the horse without stripes, the hawk flew down the colour of wine, and suddenly started a peck at my eyes. I leaped. The fisherman flung me into the sea with a mock heroic gesture, eager to tease. The ground layer of an island and the tooth of a crab at my thigh, the blood running violet, diving for coral in the hour of dread. Come up, Jonas, spit no more, just take a ticket, wind it round your finger and swallow. At first draw you'll land a silver-plated blacktail, still with jump in it, Robespierre. Or a choice wine of your choice, say, Barolo 64, to go with your lobster Thermidor. Jump in our boat, oars, nets and all, for the bout of the beasts is about to begin. And when you come to your senses, a press release will claim a son is about to be born on a carpet of white-purple flowers, lovelier than the moon, splendid as the sun, and a viper addicted to his ankle will sidle upward to peck at the wrath of grapevine. In double-handed grip, I seized a pebble with sea-made blades. In my clutch it kindled like oil spill, unfroze like a brilliant white rose, spread out like copper red-purple flowers on a spray of white wheaten sheaves, opened up in my mind like a spray of red brass, and I drew a sketch for a new Arras.
Splendid. I love this idea of the Arras taking on a life of its own. I found that really fascinating. Tell us also about the First Republic. I think this needs to be explained a bit.
The First Republic. Well, the thing is that there was so much hope and the looking forward to the Republic. And there were so many ugly events taking place as well. So I was looking at the tapestry chamber. And I could see the tiger clawing the horse without stripes, you know. That's part of the tapestry chamber. So it's really my disappointment, my sadness at what was happening at that time. All right, we were looking forward to being a republic, but there were so many ugly things happening on this little island. So, you know. Pain and almost rejection to a certain extent. I wanted to write something new. I didn't want this. I wanted something slightly better, shall we say. or much better if we could.
Of course, another theme from this collection is the sea, and it comes up in practically every yes. poem in the collection. This idea of somehow drawing strength from the water itself, and the different things that you mention very often, in actual fact, throughout the poems, algae, the green algae, the chalked hills, and of course, again, the idea of rebirth. And perhaps we could discuss that better after we've heard Dr. Hurriyep recite Delimara Bay.
Burly fishermen hurl adrift nets, in parabolas uncurl the white jablite floats. Straight unfurl the limestone weighted webbing to bait 3 miles of horizon. In the wake of the drift nets I slide head first as from my mother's womb, gliding over blue-green algae, heard the lure of the sirens guide me, search, search the rock pools for our rock crab. And I swam out and down depths where men never squinted, hunted the blue-lined pilot fish, I hate him, 1,000 fish skimming round rocks in birth throes, seaweed dancing, rising, dancing, till the chloroform stills the coryphene, sheltered under floats, forever hypnotized. And I said to myself, I have been here before. Before time lacerated the chalk heels of my friends, and they perished without trace. Before time shut the windows of my sense, stilled the birth pangs of my race. Under the shade of the drift nets curling I slept, centuries ago, cradled in matrix of coral, in spiraling stalactites, with mollusk and octopi and grouper, stood here hypnotized, lacking aqualungs without perspex to my vision, without fishing spear to my arm, whirling ages ago in search of bodily harm in the depths of Delimara. And if in some alarm I should run out of oxygen, I think I could almost stay. I will not go, for these rocks and the Seine and these algae know that I've been here before.
I really, really love this. Dr. Hurriyep tells me that it was originally in Maltese, and he liked it very much in Maltese, and I will go back and read it in Maltese, but I do like it in English.
It remains my favorite poem, I think.
Absolutely. Perhaps we could go through it a bit. Here you talk about mother's womb, birth throes. You're very interested in this idea of the life appearing, life coming,
yes.
and what happens
yes.
to it.
Well, you go into the sea and you get some kind of rebirth. Incidentally, this was the poem I didn't write 17 times. this one was here, and out it came.
Mm.
Perhaps a few touches here and there, and it was ready. So that was written in a flash, shall we say. But it had been here before.
Mm-hmm.
Not 17 times, no. Mm-hmm. That was one of the poems that was written in one spurt of help from above.
I'm not surprised to hear this, actually.
Mm.
What about some of the things that you mentioned, like chalked heels, which recurs as a theme throughout the poems in this collection? I was striving to get to the bottom of
slavery, even in Roman times. Mm. They were marked with slaves on their heels.
And you're looking at the slave as somebody who can be
freed.
Freed, obviously.
Yes.
Yes. And the algae, again, that idea of being wrapped around with
yes.
the green algae.
The algae also gives you strength, no? I mean, today, even today now, blue-green algae is something that very many people in search of vigorous health take, eat, and so on.
Kelp. It's good for us.
Yes, kelp. And kale.
Exactly. Another theme is fear and the defeat of fear, really. Mm. I got that, at least I got that impression from most of the poems that
there's,
I read.
There's fear, there's apprehension, but also there's this challenge to muzzle fear, not to be afraid of risking, facing fear frontally. And that's when you really win, when you don't, shall we say, take the coward approach and keep back, but try to continue on your way, irrespective.
Perhaps we can understand that a little better if we hear Dr. Shure reading Midnight Swim.
Can I say something about Midnight Swim? Midnight Swim was first read in Tal Hursoon, a farmhouse Tal Hursoon. That was the night when Ariadne was flying to Canada.
This is your
daughter. To go there for a 4-year course. And she was very apprehensive, very frightened, and so on. And I remember I bought her a little teddy bear about 4 feet high. And she took it, she took this teddy bear with her. And I remember writing this, actually completing this. It was already on. And I read it first in the Tal Hursoon farmhouse for a group of poetry lovers and so on. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, there's a personal aspect to it as well.
Don't listen. Don't listen to this, unless swimming in darkest night, you grieved to miss a child, blue-green algae brushing your hand, sensing squid, shark, or octopus, breeding fear in the dark. I say you never understand daughters or Caesar, right, unless through the gathering storm you've swum in blue-green algae, grieving for the waning spark, frothing her healing wounds like Perno lathering her long black hair in the dark. If now in ritual you dare to curl your hair straight back, swimming on your back, from island to island slowly crossing, your mouth like mine, the sea brine gargling, the silent wind will have you listen to a white lateen sail. The wail of a child in the Lutsu, late with 20 men on board, a last vow on their lost lips, and one, just the one, clinging till saving dawn fast to a rock, above his head sheer water squealing, reading the hand of the underwater diver running out of time, trapped under a reef with a fired harpoon, in pain, surprise, awaiting Christian burial and grief 7 years in the bay of dark slaughter, the daughter seeking relief, recognizing her gift watch. Hold your breath now, start the breaststroke where the tuna nets start locking. Turn around again, refrain from mocking, staying you'll be trapped in ritual slaying. Now dare to dive again with me, my left arm around green-blue algae. You shall see every 6 seconds the beam of the lighthouse breaking free, or a helicopter's searchlight searching your sunken city beneath the sea. Dive down, then, and keep on diving along stairs of pale red coral, time-warped sculptors carving sing down wide curving corridors and halls. You can hear the chisels ring on a horse 12 meters high, loosing it out of black granite. Straight as plumb line now start rising. Hear steam hammers hiss and splutter. Hear jackhammers din vibrating. Bells from belfries wildly ringing. Hail the coming of the schooners and the measured welcome of the drums for those who arrive because they were never afraid to be lost at sea in the dark.
Stupendous. Those last three lines are really memorable. Before asking Professor Master to read a particular poem that I really, really liked, I'd like to mention also your son's photography. Pierre has some really, really wonderful photographs in this book, and I think they really complement.
He really worked very hard.
They complement the poems absolutely beautifully. I really wanted to mention that before we end, as unfortunately our time is almost up. I have really enjoyed the collection. The ones I've read, I've read quite a few of them now. I also like the one about PSI. I really like that one as well. Unfortunately, we don't have much time to go and discuss any further, but
Actually, there's another one about PSI, eh? The one about from Ramblas Market, The Goose and Clown. That's also PSI.
Also about him. Well, I mean, he should loom large in your writing, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I would like you to read, just for me, please, because I love it so much, Ship of Dreams.
I'll do that. In Dimensions of the Moon, by the Cables and Anchors of Hurt. The girl I loved returns no more. In moving wet sand, I have to mold again the pain, the alabaster face of the virgin who wore a rose in her hair, beautiful as dream. Like a sword of trust by the shores of indolence, my diver's knife must keep vigil with the girl who lost her mirth and innocence by the seaside vineyards of hurt, waiting in hope for the ropes that lead her to her ship of dreams to rise, laden with cedars and myrrh. I shall go down. The ship of dreams has surfaced and sunk. I shall skin dive, roam our seabed, till I can mold again the alabaster face of a virgin waiting in hope for the rope that leads her to her ship of dreams. In the mansions of the moon, in the vineyards of plenty, I shall pick no more flowers.
Professor Mossop, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And thank you, Dr. Shriram, for your readings.
It was a
really,
pleasure.
Really wonderful. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġġu plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.